This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The sand is marvelously fine on the beaches of Gaza. The Mediterranean Sea along its coast is just like the travel brochure for a Club Med resort. But there is no Club Med resort here. There are no glossy travel brochures for Gaza. And John Elmer, our next guest, didn't go there for a holiday. No one does. John is a photojournalist who went to Gaza to see how the Palestinian people in that most densely packed corner of the globe managed to exist. Good morning, John.
Thanks for having me.
Now, major media have reporters in Israel. Did you cross paths with them in Gaza?
Pretty much not at all. The wire services, Reuters, Agence France-Presse, Associated Press, they have reporters there, but by and large, they're indigenous Palestinian reporters and the sort of foreign reporters that we think about when we think about conflict reporting. It doesn't really exist in Gaza, not because it can't exist, but because they simply choose to not do it. The Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the CBC all have correspondents in Jerusalem, about a 40-minute drive from Gaza. And there's no reason, Gaza is dangerous, but in relative terms, the journalists have no issue. And it's just a choice they make to simply not travel to Gaza.
So how do they do reports from there if they're not actually going there?
Well, the New York Times wrote an interesting front page story during the Fatah-Hamas clashes that were happening, the internal fighting. And they wrote a story. It was important because they said Hamas was winning on the street, that their militias were defeating the forces loyal to President Abbas, the Western-backed forces. And they did this important story by making telephone calls to people in Gaza and simply asking what the result was on the street and filing a story, Dateline Jerusalem. So even an important story like this, which really wasn't told by anyone else, was told from telephone calls from Jerusalem, which, of course, you can extrapolate. You could simply make those telephone calls from Toronto as well. And you couldn't get further away from the Gaza Strip than Jerusalem in terms of quality of life, in terms of context, and really understanding what's going on in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are increasingly simply, as you mentioned, isolated ghettos, cut off from the rest of the world with no independent, viable economy or foreign policy, or even freedom of movement.
And the reason that they give is that it's too dangerous to go there.
That's generally the issue. A lot of journalists, there's beyond the sort of systemic analysis of why these journalists are not doing this. I think it's important to note that there's a lot of self-censorship that goes on. Journalists choose, because of the pressures of their datelines and deadlines, to file the story as simply as they can. And there was a report done by a colleague of mine who analyzed the reports of the Toronto Star, and 55 reports filed by Mitch Potter over the last 6 months, 47 of them were from Jerusalem. And so that really means he's sitting at his desk and really not experiencing the conflict.
Now, from the moment that Hamas was elected as the major governing party in Palestine, Israel successfully pressed foreign governments to impose a boycott on the Palestinians. What are the consequences of that?
Well, the boycott and the sanctions is, first of all, the first ever applied on an occupied population. Generally, sanctions regimes are imposed upon the occupier as a way to exact change. But this sanctions regime has been in place on an already occupied population that's living in desperate conditions. So, for instance, in 2004, 2 years before the sanctions regime began, the World Bank reported that the Palestinian collapse was, quote, among the worst in modern history. So this is a real serious issue that these sanctions regimes have been applied upon. The World Food Program says that 1.1 out of 1.4 million people in Gaza are totally dependent on food aid. This is what the sanctions regime has been applied to. So the 20% of the Palestinian population that was employed previously and supporting the rest of the society has been rendered unemployed. And that sanctions regime, it's important to note for Canadian listeners, is the number one issue at any Palestinian dinner table right now. It's not the internal fighting. It's not the Israeli bombings or tank incursions. It's the sanctions regime that's made it impossible for people to live day by day, to simply get food and to take care of their children, to take care of the most base elements of their life.
So is there malnutrition?
Absolutely. There's been Since June, when the Israeli soldier was taken prisoner in Gaza, there's been a total ban on fishing. And so I did an interview with the World Food Program, and they noted to me that one-third of the protein in the Gaza diet comes from fish. A diet, it's worth noting, 80% of the population in Gaza living less than $2.15 a day, $2.15, $800 a year. And so the total ban on fishing has led to the direct imposition of malnutrition, because you have one-third of the animal protein removed from the diet.
And the ban on fishing is a direct result of the siege?
It's a direct result of the security analysis that Israel deploys, the idea being that this soldier could be squirreled out of the Gaza Strip by the sea. And they've done a number of these sort of tactics that are justified under the taking prisoner of this soldier, including the bombing of the power station in Gaza. So the main source of electricity for Gaza has been eliminated, and for 8 months people are living with no power. This is the real, on-the-ground reality that this sanctions regime has been imposed upon, and it was something that was told explicitly was to overthrow the government of Hamas. The key advisor to the Olmert and Sharon government, Dov Weisglass, said, "We're going to put Palestinians on a diet." Canadian Foreign Minister Peter MacKay said, "Not one red cent to Hamas." And the idea has been explicitly that Palestinians are being punished for their democratic and electoral choices.
What's the effect on the social bonds and mental health, I guess you could say, of people in Gaza?
Well, there's an important doctor doing work, mental health doctor Ayad Siraj in Gaza, and he works on this concept of what we understand as post-traumatic stress disorder. But he frames it in terms of ongoing traumatic stress disorder. In other words, it never ends for the population. So the sanctions regime, the Israeli incursions, the internal fighting, the economic collapse, the lack of movement, these are all social, these are all attacking the social bonds. And Palestinians have amazing network of social bonds, because 60 years of occupation and dispossession has forced them to all take care of one another in societal ways that are very important. The sanctions regime has really undercut that. The society was already tenuous, and the sanctions regime has really pulled that apart and created a situation where there's really utter despair in Gaza. It's, an 80-year-old grandmother who lived through two or three displacements would look you in the eyes and tell you that today is the worst day of the Palestinian struggle that they've ever experienced.
One of the political differences between Fatah and Hamas concerns the unwillingness of Hamas to recognize the right of Israel to exist. Can you explain the significance of that phrase, the right to exist?
Well, in terms of the Palestinian position, in terms of Hamas's position, their first question is, what Israel do we recognize? Israel is the only country in the world with no recognized borders, and that's the case because it's been a constant expansionist project since the UN resolutions that provided Israel's international legitimacy, which was only in 55% of historical Palestine. And right now, Israel controls 100% of historical Palestine. And that's an important distinction. It's important to understand that Israel has no borders. And so when Palestinians are forced to recognize when a people are forced to recognize a nation state, which is actually the first time that's ever happened, nation states recognize nation states, but the Palestinians aren't a nation state. They're an occupied population living in ghettos, quite literally, within the state of Israel. To ask a people, a popular movement, to recognize a state is really an absurdity that we've never seen before in international relations, and one that Israel would not recognize reciprocally for the Palestinians, namely their right to exist.
Now, you say that at the dinner tables, people aren't talking about Fatah and Hamas. But did you get a sense when you did talk to people about the two organizations, how people felt about them?
Sure. And let me just clarify, they did talk about it at dinner. But the number one issue is the sanctions regime,
right,
is what I mean. But at the dinner tables, of course, the Palestinians are very political culture, and the personal is political very much when you're living under occupation. And so families, this concept of a civil war, it's not a civil war. You have two members of one family that are Fatah, two members that are Hamas, two members that are independent, and they spend their dinner time fighting about politics. Absolutely, there's no question. And many friends would come over to my house after to decompress after their fights with their family, while on the street, the same political parties were fighting pitched battles. It's very deeply political society, and I think people were generally, by and large, disgusted with the internal fighting. It's not a civil war. It's not a broad-based struggle. It was a power struggle carried out between two militias, one U.S.-backed militia that's attempting to overthrow the democratically elected government, and the government, namely Hamas, who is, for the first time in its 20-year history, fighting back against provocations, against arrest, imprisonment, torture, and exile, which the Palestinian Authority under Fatah executed against Hamas for 15 years at Israel and the United States' behest.
What role does Canada play in Gaza?
Well, Peter McKay was just in Israel when I was there, and he was lauded in Israel on three fronts. One, because of the sanctions regime, not one red cent to Hamas. Number two was because of the diplomatic support that Canada gave to Israel during its summer war with Hezbollah, when really all Israel needed was not money or weapons, but simply diplomatic support, allow them time within the international community to carry out the attack on Hezbollah. Well, as we well know, Harper and Peter McKay were at the forefront of that. And also, and I think more worryingly for Canadians, Israel lauded the Harper government for being, quote, at the vanguard of the isolation of Iran. In other words, the next stage in this imperial war, and Canada's immediately involved and, quote, at the vanguard of it. You know, Canadian forces on the ground are training Fatah forces, security forces, just like Canada trains security forces in Haiti and in Iraq and in Afghanistan. They're training security forces in Palestine as well, under the United States and, interestingly enough, the United Nations, but under the director of Lieutenant General Keith Dayton, who's the American security coordinator in Israel and Palestine. They're actively and openly and not secretly training Fatah forces in counterinsurgency war.
Tell me more about that, because this is not, I think, something that's generally known.
No, it's generally not, but when Peter McKay went there, he bragged about it. It was no secret that we had that half of General Dayton, who's the U.S. security coordinator, who's training these forces, half of his staff is Canadian. The CBC bragged about this, Peter McKay bragged about this, the Department of Foreign Affairs bragged about this, and it's involved in a project to train the presidential guard loyal to Mahmoud Abbas, loyal to the president, but not loyal to the elected government. So Canada is training forces not loyal to the elected government. Just like in Haiti, Canada's training forces in order to cement an illegal coup of a democratically elected government. Or in Iraq, we're training security forces to prop up a puppet government that the United States has imposed on the Iraqi population. Or in Afghanistan, where we're training security forces for a government that controls maybe a few neighborhoods in the capital. So this is what Canada's involved in. And then Canada calls it the three Ds, diplomacy, development, and defense. And so we have a defense element going on in Afghanistan, which is actually more accurately called offense, since we're occupying a foreign country, development aid, which we see in Haiti, used to cement a coup, and diplomatic intervention in Palestine, where diplomatically Canada is supporting a brutal sanctions regime on the Palestinian population. According to Canadian foreign policy analysis, these three Ds are interchangeable and inextricable from one another. So Canadian foreign policy is very focused on the Middle East and very focused in undermining the democratically elected government there.
You're going to be speaking this coming Tuesday at 3 o'clock, and I encourage people to go along and hear more of what you have to say. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.
I've been speaking with John Elmer. He's a photojournalist. You can see his photos at his website, johnelmer.ca. And John is going to be speaking on Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center, Maggie Benston Center Room, which is at 2296. And he's also going to speak in Victoria on Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the Elliott Building in Room 167. You're listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.